Welcome to the podcast that challenges you from the inside. Come be more and discover the agile within. And now here's your host, Greg Miller.
Another beautiful day, at least here in my part of the country. So this is remarkable how we can record this. We have Mark, who's in South Carolina. I'm in Ohio. And our guest today is in Nashville, Tennessee. Her name is Michelle Paulk. She's an agile leadership coach. And today's topic is all about resistance to change. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So change, yeah, resistance. So this is, if obviously you're into agile or really anything that you're going to do new, we as humans are kind of, you know, we're wired to not really like change, right? And Michelle's going to talk to us about why people are resistant to change. Why is it so difficult to change something?
People, but not us, right, Greg?
Not us.
That's
Right. Yeah.
No, of course not.
So there's other people that are the problem.
It's everybody else.
Yeah, that's the thing I think is so funny when we talk about change and where we start to experience resistance is that it's always so easy to become instantly frustrated with someone else for not following along with the change that you'd like them to move forward with. And when we think about when we're asked to change, you know, for most people, the first thing that we do is resist, either, you know, outwardly or even just internally asking like, well, why do I need to do this? Or where is this coming from? Even asking that question is a subtle way of presenting some resistance. So it's something I think, you know, there's a lot of hand-wringing about it, especially in our agile community, but it's such a natural, it is a completely natural part of change.
Yes, exactly. So, why do you think people are so resistant to change?
Yeah, so I have it's actually been doing some videos on LinkedIn about, you know, there's lots of reasons. One that I've been talking about and thinking about recently is we get through the SCARF model created by David Rock of the Neuro Leadership Institute, and he talks about using the recent brain science for the last couple decades to help us understand why people resist change. And so, you know, basically he's talking about how we feel threatened across different dimensions when a change is introduced, and they may be, so SCARF being an acronym that stands for status, certainty, autonomy, relatedness, and fairness. And when we feel or perceive a across one of those, we're likely to shut down and resist, and you know, the things that are happening in our brain, actually, you know, it's like a fight or flight response. So the resources that we have to be creative, to be engaged or open to possibility, all of those get diverted into like, ooh, I need to protect myself from whatever the situation is. And so we have less available to do, you know, to be open-minded or think about how things could work when we're perceiving some kind of threat.
Yeah. I've never heard of that SCARF model. Can we go through some of that?
Yeah, absolutely.
If our listeners have never heard of that, it's you mentioned it off the air before, and I did see your post on that. I think it's very interesting. Maybe we can go through that.
Yeah. It's some really fascinating work. You know, if you're curious about it, the Neuro Leadership Institute has some information there. You can do like a little self-assessment and see, you know, of those elements, like which ones are most likely to trigger you. But just to start like with, so the first element is status. And so thinking about this actually just yesterday, you know, where you know, some of my experiences in agile coaching where I've found like pushback from the team, a lot of them, you know, might be when you have a leader on the team. So it could be somebody mm-hmm. who's got a higher title, like a team lead, or it might be the manager for the team. And you know, in the past, I've had these experiences very commonly. It's like talking to the team about, oh, we want to elevate everyone's voices here. We have no titles being recognized on a scrum team.
Exactly.
There's no role for the manager. And usually people freak out about that.
Exactly. Yes. And, yes, they do.
And my response in the past has been sort of just like, well, buckle up, Buttercup. This is what's happening. And right. Of course, you know, people, depending on their personality and how they deal with change, you know, they may be polite about that in a conversation. But that naturally they're going to feel threatened if, you know, something they've worked for a long time is now just being taken away by this new way of working. Of course, that's going to create a sense of loss or confusion or frustration or anger for that person. So, you know, there's very subtle ways that we can threaten status and we don't even realize. That's like one of the ones that I see all the time. I think about a lot when I'm starting to work with a team.
I've seen it a lot. Yeah. As you were saying that, I'm thinking I come across it definitely with leaders, like outside the team, like directors, VPs that I have to talk to, right? You definitely see it there. You feel it. And a lot on the teams is status. It's usually when I have a team member that's been there for years, like you kind of mentioned, has a lot of knowledge, you know, in the old waterfall where knowledge is power, right? And I have all this knowledge and, oh, they've been, you know, this person's been here for 20 years. That's instantly status, right? Just saying that, right?
Yeah.
And if they've been working in this, oh, you know, they know this inside and out. They've been working in this product for 15 years. Okay. So that's right there. You're setting it up for status. And then to your point, someone like me comes in and says, you know what? All that knowledge you have, I want you to share it with everybody on the team.
Right.
And I want everybody to be able to do what you do.
So, yeah.
And when you're living in a world of, well, I have status because I have all this knowledge. And now I'm telling you, to break down that status. That's very threatening. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead, Mark. What were you going to say?
Yeah. I was just going to say that. So I definitely agree with that. There's also another side. And if anybody has ever heard of the acronym HIPPO, the highest paid person's opinion.
Yeah.
You walk into you're in a meeting and all of a sudden, you know, the CEO, CFO, CXO steps in and offers their opinion. Suddenly everybody just defers, right?
It gets
quiet. And so as leaders, you know, so I'm a scrum master. And so I really don't have any authority. And so how do I influence others at the team level, but also above me that are the executive level, at the management level? How do you influence them? Because maybe there are some patterns that they're accustomed to doing that. And the knowledge is one aspect to get over, but I would say it's as challenging, if not more challenging, to face the executive side. And maybe you can talk about that, Michelle.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so that I think, you know, is such a common challenge. And it was so frustrating for me for years that I ended up going back to graduate school to be trained as an executive coach because I could not crack that problem. Like, how do I talk with these folks who, you know, you can take a team to a certain level and then they are going to be limited by however far their leader wants them to go. And that of course makes sense, you know, but we get into these weird situations where the leader is sponsoring the team to work in an agile way. And at the same time, they don't fully understand what's implied for their own work and how they might need to shift in terms of their leadership behaviors or mindset to really see the value that they were hoping to get out of the team working in that way. So I think, you know, as a scrum master, like, you have this really challenging position because you're charged with creating change. You have no authority. And so it's purely influence based. And then we bring in these radical ideas like, hey, let's flatten the hierarchy and which is going to be threatened. Like the people you need to buy into that are immediately going to be threatened by that. So I think, you know, the first piece of that is just having awareness of the truly radical nature of the ideas that you are bringing. And so, you know, when we think about how would an executive or a director or a, you know, person in the C-suite respond to being told, you know, things around like, oh, well, we're going to leave. This is a team decision, or the team is self-organizing. Like, this isn't your choice to make, or things like that. Like, in many ways, you know, if we bring kind of too radical of an idea forward before that person is ready to hear it, we will see resistance flare up and, you know, all of our work gets shut down. So I think there's like some gentle probing and inquiry to be done to see, you know, what is it that is motivating this executive to sponsor the change? And what do they believe is implied in that? And what are they willing to address along the way? And one of the things that I'm continuing to learn as I work as an agile coach is that my assumptions about what they want from working in an agile way are very rarely aligned with they actually want. And so that's a continual process of surfacing, like, what is the problem that you're trying to solve by working in this way? And how do we uncover that together through dialogue? So that's kind of a first thought about that.
Right.
What is your experience been?
I was good. Let's move on to the C. I want to get through all the C, A, R. Let's move on to the C part if we can, the Y.
Yeah, absolutely. So the C is certainty. And so when we talk about change, anytime we're introducing change, we're introducing uncertainty, which is threatening to the brain. And David Rock talks about how the brain is a pattern recognition machine, and there's so many things that we don't even realize we have come to expect and make assumptions about and fill in the gaps, like, unconsciously, so that we can do higher level kinds of thinking and tasks. So just for example, like, if you're drinking coffee right now, like I am, you're going to pick up your mug and you have like, your brain has already got assumptions about how heavy it's going to be, like, you know, how tightly you need to grip that. Like, so if it were slippery, or if like it were way lighter, that, you know, you find yourself spilling all of those kinds of things. So like, and we don't, for everyday tasks, you know, you don't need a lot of attention on things that are predictable. But when, you know, so when we think about habits and routines and just knowing how things are, that allows us to focus our attention on higher level problems. But when we introduce change, like, even if it's like, okay, now we're working in Scrum and we're not estimating things the way you used to, like, welcome to the world of story points. You are just messing with people at like a crazy level. It's like, I don't understand what this means. What, you know, conceptually, and then how does this fit into my normal routine? Like, you're breaking, you have to unlearn, relearn, and the whole time in the back of your head, you're asking yourself, is this worth it? So, that when we create uncertainty, like, all of our attention gets diverted to like figuring out what's going to happen next. So, you know, one of the things, Agile and Scrum do a great job of helping us work through uncertainty in the environment by creating like predictable patterns. Like, hey, we're going to meet every 2 weeks, even though we can't have a plan for the next 6 months necessarily, we're going to inspect that every 2 weeks, or we're going to break something that's really big down into small pieces. And that's a way of, you know, making it a little bit easier when we're dealing with uncertainty. But the change of moving to a different way of working creates uncertainty in itself.
Just moving to it.
People don't know what to expect.
Right. But to your point, it does have, once you get into it, it does have its repeatable processes that bring, the whole time you're talking, I'm thinking like, would like comfort be the right word? Maybe comfortable.
Yeah.
People feel comfortable if certainty.
Yeah.
Your coffee cup was a great example. I know that when I lift this up, unless I drank way more than I realize, it's going to be, hey, I'm disappointed because where's all my coffee? Oh, I just, oh yeah. But I'm thinking comfort the whole time and people in their comfort zone, right? Which is not really what Agile is about. It's getting out of our comfort zones. And you know, there's the process of Scrum, like you said, is down, you know, okay, every day, 15 minutes this time.
Right.
I'm going to do daily Scrum. I'm going to do it. Yeah. But outside of that, it's not comfortable.
Well, and remember, like, for those of us who live and breathe this stuff, it's comfortable for us. But there's a lot that we that's inside of Agile, like the jargon that we use that we don't even recognize as jargon, like that creates uncertainty. So like, oh, okay, you're a Scrum Master. What on earth is that? Is that a project? Like, I don't even know if I've never encountered that before, how to understand this person's role or what they're there to do. And so people get distracted by trying to figure out what the pattern is. So, you know, there's like ways that we can use like the, even the frameworks, like breaking it down. If we think about, okay, you're introducing a new way of working to a team. How do you break that big thing down into small digestible chunks so that it's just like, you know, you're taking an agile approach to your agile transformation, if you will. Like, how do you, how do you make that, you know, more digestible? How do you create some like certainty where there's, so if you know teams tend to have like a lot of skepticism in the beginning, then they maybe warm up to it, then they freak out. Like, you know, if you have a narrative that you've seen over and over again, even sharing that pattern of like, you aren't going to like me for at least 6 weeks, and then you might think I'm okay. like, you know, just letting them know this is going to hurt, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That can create a little bit of safety there. It's like your doctor, you know, if you're going and you're going to have surgery and they don't prep you, like, this is going to be painful and like, it's going to sting a little bit. Like, just having that awareness helps people relax a little bit into what's happening. Yeah,
exactly.
So how does that tie in with, so one of the things that I think about often is the side of the other person of loss aversion. It's like, you're telling me these new ways of working, but that likely means I'm going to have to give up some of the certainty and the things that I've grown accustomed to. And I don't want to do that.
Right.
You know, we talked about being comfortable, but how does it relate? How can you give us some tips on relating to that, to, you know, relating to somebody who's scared because they're going to lose something?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think the first thing there is to be aware that that is likely going to be the experience for many people on the team. So there will be some people who will be enthusiastic about trying something new. There will be some people who are 100% opposed to trying something new. And then most people will be like somewhere in the middle where they're, you know, kind of, all right, well, maybe this, I'm open to seeing what's happening. I don't really, I'm not going to fight, or I'm also not going to push it forward. They'll just be passive about it.
Exactly.
Yeah. But for the people who, you know, are really hurting from that loss, I think they're, you know, like you'll hear in a lot of existing like change management. So, you know, the sort of dominant thinking about that tends to be, oh, either ignore it, like just pretend it's not there. Like, don't give them an audience. Like, don't let them like share that very broadly, or like, you know, be, make it uncomfortable for them to resist, like, you know, escalate to their management or tell them, you know, on the bus or under it or whatever kind of brutal tactics, you know, seem to be effective. And, you know, there's plenty of examples that throughout history where people have used both of those methods
and definitely
had some kind of result, but it's usually not lasting. Or like the second that the person who's pushing the change steps away, then those folks just go back to what they were doing before. So what I suggest is like a alternative to both of those things is creating the space to really explore like what is that loss and give that voice. So, you know, instead of just saying, everybody, this is Agile, this is going to change your life and you're so welcome, you know, giving some room for people to think about, okay, if we were to move in this direction, what would be different about it? You know, what are some of the things that could be beneficial? what would we be giving up, and what are our thoughts about that? So what are the things that we don't want to lose as a process of making this change? And you might find, you know, through that conversation, like people are thinking, oh, well, what I really like about my work today is I get to set my own schedule. And there, that may stretch beyond the boundary of their work day. It might be, I need my own schedule because I've got kids or other people that I'm taking care of, and I need to make sure I have that kind of flexibility. And if they're feeling like that is going to be threatened by this way of working, you know, that may cause them to resist in different kinds of ways. But if we know like where the issue is coming from, then we can find a way to design a solution, you know, that accommodates for that. So, you know, giving a space, and that might be one-on-one conversations. It might be through a, you know, very neutrally facilitated retrospective conversation, but making sure that people understand that it's open and encouraged and welcome to give voice to the things that they are skeptical about or, you know, really not enthusiastic about.
Right. So is that the A? What's the A in SCARF?
Oh, sorry.
Is that a version? Is that a version that Mark said? No. Okay.
No, it's so the A in SCARF is autonomy.
Autonomy.
So like the example I just gave around, like, you know, your schedule.
Okay.
There may be a threat to autonomy when people are, you know, resisting like working in a more concentrated team environment. So, you know, a lot of software developers like to work by themselves. Like, oh, I wanted to code because I didn't want to have to talk to anybody.
Exactly.
And then you're like, hey, we're working in an agile way. Now you all are doing pair programming for 8 hours a day. Like, no, thank you. And
exactly.
So there are some people that's going to work for and others that won't. So, you know, exploring what is like, just where are their preferences? But, you know, the ways that we can make that a better situation for folks is allowing for choice wherever possible. So there may be some constraints. You know, if we're working in a team environment, we've got to have a time for all of us to meet. But, you know, giving some freedom around, you know, anything that we don't have to have determined as a group, you know, giving space and choice and allowing for the teams to self-organize around that is really important for, you know, addressing that potential threat to autonomy.
Yeah. I found, I'm trying to think of some of the people that want the autonomy. I'm trying to, in my experience, if they've been, the devs that I've experienced, like, you know, the stereotypical leave me alone, I just want to code and eat pizza and drink Mountain Dew, right? That type of stereotypical thing of developers. I've not come across that a ton. The ones that are kind of like, I've experienced some that they're quiet resistors.
Yeah.
They're like, they'll go along. They'll do it. Like you said earlier, they're not going to support it, and they're not really going to like fight you, but I know that they don't really care for it.
Right.
But they'll do it. They'll do it. They just, as long as you just let them code, you know, sit in a corner sometimes, you know, by themselves, they'll begrudgingly go along. They're not going to give you a big fight. But you know, they don't like it. So they just, I'm fine with those. I just kind of like those people. I just kind of like leave alone. But I let them know that they're part of the team. And,
in some aspects, those are the more challenging ones to work with.
You're
trying to figure out where they stand. Whereas if you have somebody who's very vocal, at least you know what their opinion is, and you can have a starting point to, okay, I understand what you don't like. Let's talk about that. Whereas the people you're talking about, Greg, you're trying so hard to pull information about what you don't like. How can I help you? What could we do better? And when there's silence, that's tough.
Yeah. Sometimes I don't know what to do with silence, but there's people like that where I get to a point where I have a person in mind. I get to the point where I know how they feel because they've showed me rather than tell me.
Right? Yeah.
They've showed me by their actions. And I'm like, okay, I kind of maybe for good or for bad, probably bad. I put that person in a little box and say, okay, that person is, I know what I need to know about that person. If they want me to know more, they'll tell me. And I just like, okay, they're not going to give me too much of a trouble. Every now and then they'll make a smirky face and, you know, roll their eyes, but that's okay. They're going to go along with it. So I just kind of like, don't put too much energy in them after a certain point, which might be bad, but if they want to talk to me, they can.
Yeah. That's, you know, I think like what you guys are talking about there with the, you know, folks who are quiet and they, you have a sense that there's something that they're not supportive of, or they're not on board, but they're not going to come out and say it directly or take the risk. Like that, I think, so just in terms of like social science research there, like when we go through change, you know, about 80% of people will fall into that group.
Hmm. Really?
So yeah. Wow. Like, so 10% will go along with be gung-ho about the change. Another 10% are going to resist it in an active kind of way. And 80% will just be in this passive kind of wow. gray zone. And so when you think about that, if that's most of the team, like, it is absolutely no mm-hmm. wonder to me that, you know, so many agile transformations, they'll make some progress, I guess, in agile ways of working while they have a coach or somebody assigned to working with them. But the second that person walks away, they go back to doing what they were doing. And why yeah. is that? Like, my theory around that is you have, well, the 10% of the team that was excited about it, you know, they were making it happen while the coach was there. And then the 80%, once the coach leaves, the 80% are like, yeah, no, we're going back.
Nope.
Right? So, yeah. Does that track with what you've experienced as well? Or
I'm trying to think. I'm shocked. 80 seems high to me.
Me too.
Yeah, it feels high, but I.
Well, think about think about it this way, right? The three of us would be in that 10% of like, yay, mm-hmm. agile, right? Yeah. We've decided to devote our lives to this, like, as a profession. That's kind of next level when you think about just processes. Well,
yeah, it's true.
You know, enthusiasm for process. So like knowing where you are on the spectrum, and then thinking okay. to like let's take. I think a lot about. I recently worked with a fitness trainer, and this woman was amazing, and like she has all of these, you know, awesome tips about nutrition and like, you know, she's got an exercise like strength workout program, and I'm learning all this stuff, and you know, really enjoying like what I'm getting from working with her. And at the same time, like, I am never going to be like at her level of fitness or like, you know, thoughtfulness about my nutrition. Like, I like to eat cake. These are things that I'm not like willing to completely give up in order to see like results at the level that she's seeing. So if mm-hmm. if you look at like, if you think about
that's a agile, great analogy,
right? Right. It's like, yeah, you're, I'm hiring her because she's super into it. I don't want her to make me super into it. I just want to learn like what are the things that I can sustain over my life that are going to give me benefit in terms of health outcomes and, you know, those kinds of things. So like, I'm learning from her. I'm finding total value from working with her. And at no point, like, if she had pushed me to like, okay, well, now you need to start training at the same level that, you know, she's training, like, that would have been a hard pass. No, thank you.
Yeah. No. Okay. I guess. Okay. If you look at it that way, if you're saying 80% are like 10% are like us.
Yeah.
If you phrase it that way. Yeah, I would probably say there aren't many people on a dev team that I've been associated with that want to be in my position.
Right. Right.
I've had one or maybe two people ever that have come to me and said, I want to do what you do, and actually have done it.
Yes.
In 13 years. So, okay. Now I'm starting to buy that now.
Yeah.
Buy that number a little more now. Yeah. Okay.
But that's not to say that the 80%, can't benefit from agile ways of working. So the 80% are right. like me with my trainer, where it's like, before I started working with her, I avoided strength training at all costs. I'm like, that's like unpleasant and I don't enjoy it. Well, it doesn't mean I don't need to do it. So you know, for the same thing with these teams, like it may be, they may not particularly enjoy like having a retrospective conversation. They can still at the same time see benefit from doing that and may like decide, yeah, this is something I need to make time for because I see the value in it, even though I'm not like an enthusiast.
Right.
That's
right?
a great example, Michelle, because
it is.
Now I'm putting my developer hat on because I started my career as a developer. And thinking about when I walk into a retrospective, the thing that I loved was I loved the craft of programming.
Yeah.
You know, there's a certain element of writing well-written, very easily maintainable code. And when you walk into a retrospective, it's very easy just to fall in love with that aspect of your job. And that's all you talk about. But there's a whole other side that agile coaches and scrum masters work very hard to bring out. And it's how are we working together?
Yeah.
How are we pleasing our customers? You know, what is the process that we're going through of getting better, not just individually, but working better together? So again, it just what you're saying. I really like your analogy of working with a fitness trainer. So,
that was
fits
good.
Really well.
So let's move on. Let's move on to the R. I want to get through the scarf.
Let's move on
to the R. Yeah.
So the R is relatedness. So that means like social belonging. You know, how do we feel included or excluded from a group? And, you know, the stuff from the science there is around like pain, like we actually experience pain, like from social rejection, like they do brain imaging studies and the same part of your brain that lights up if you're experiencing physical brain, that physical pain is the one that will light up if you're experiencing social rejection.
Really?
So that's, it's like, so like when you're like, oh, it hurts like to be left out, like for real.
It really does hurt.
And so, you know, when we think about a team setting, okay, so autonomy is going to go down in a team setting, but relatedness is likely to go up because we've got people that we're associating with regularly. Mm-hmm. And so for Scrum Masters, I think a lot of us are really attuned to how are those dynamics affecting people's sense of belonging or inclusion in the team. And so, these are things where like the nice thing about the SCARF model is that, you know, all of these pieces work together. So, you know, while you may be threatening someone, the situation may be threatening to someone from a status perspective, you might be able to counteract that with increased relatedness, right?
Yeah.
So there's some interrelationship there that can be useful to explore. There's a lot on a team. I'm sure you guys have seen this, where we get these different like discipline, you know, some fractures in the team around disciplines or roles. Like, QA people often feel like they're second class citizens because their work comes last. Even like, you know, if you look at how they're paid, they're usually paid less than.
Correct.
So there's status implied there. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when we're thinking about how to increase rewards from relatedness in a team setting, you know, finding ways to make sure that those voices are elevated, you know, okay, how do we start considering testing in the very beginning part of the sprint instead of like leaving that to the end where, you know, this is the one person who gets stuck like doing overtime because, you know, nobody considered them, you know, those like, or just including their thoughts in how we estimate or how we plan. Like those are ways to help, you know, people who may have previously been like suffering from lower perceived status in the team or in the organization, you know, see some rewards from working in a team where they're, you know, appreciated in a new way or elevated in a new way. So those are just some thoughts about that one. Yeah.
I have no idea what you're talking about here.
No idea.
This is foreign.
You can't relate.
I know. Like, that must be your weird teams. Like, what are you doing to them?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So let's move on to the F, the last letter.
Yeah. Star. Yeah. The last one's fairness. Mm-hmm. And this one, you know, the science there is around like when just fair exchanges are perceived to be intrinsically rewarding. So when things feel fair, even if you're not like benefiting from it in some, I got more than some other person or whatever. If you feel like it's fair, that just is rewarding to the brain. And by the converse, anything that's unfair is threatening. It activates like really strong emotions similar to disgust or things like it can be pretty intense. So
yeah,
you know, what's kind of cool when we think about agile ways of working and our sense of fairness in the workplace, having like self-organizing teams, you know, where they've set their own rules and they're holding themselves accountable to them, that mm-hmm. is going to increase the rewards that we would perceive from fairness. So if we've got like, okay, you know, this is how we've decided we're going to, you know, govern ourselves. And then you get into this conversation that may be challenging, like in the retrospective about how people aren't pulling their weight or whatever.
Yeah.
If it's a rule that was set by the team, that mm-hmm. is an easier conversation for people to have. It's less triggering than if it's like the boss right. coming in and telling them like, you all failed exactly. to meet my expectations. Like, well, your expectations were unreasonable. You're like,
not fair.
You don't,
yeah, right.
Yeah, you don't have that exactly. same kind of dynamic at play. So there's like some built-in advantages in just the way that those frameworks work that can help us from a fairness perspective. But, you know, I think this also ties back to that status thing. Changing how people are working, and it's like, oh, I worked hard and I earned that title, and now you're taking it away from
in a way.
Me.
Right.
That doesn't right. feel good. So,
yeah,
you know, a lot to consider there.
I mean, even though, you know, you've said now and just before about, you know, Scrum does say there's no, it just says there's Scrum Master, product owner, and dev team.
Yep.
My experience in reality is companies still don't just have, you know, we call it the dev team,
right.
but like my teams now still have team leads. All the teams have team leads. They have the different levels, the senior, it's QA, BAs. They still operate that way.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say never. I've rarely seen where members of the dev team have like, to your point, fairness have been like, a title's been taken away from them. I haven't seen that happen. Yeah.
Yeah. I've, you know, heard like some different places I've worked have been a little bit stronger about like discouraging the use of title or like even talking mm-hmm. about it or what have you. And I think usually that's well intentioned in that, oh, we want to make sure that we have equal voices on the team. And at the same time, I think there's like this unintended consequence that can come along with promoting a lot of that stuff. And I'm like all about the let's flatten the hierarchy and whatever.
Yeah.
Like, that appeals to me just at a yeah. philosophical level. And at the same time,
I don't care about my title. I've always,
yeah.
I tell my current managers, like, I don't care what my title is. It's what I do. It's the things I do
right.
that I care more about than what you call me. I don't care what you call me, but
right. Well, and I've ascribed to that like myself, and then, but you know, reading some of the stuff about the scarf models shifted my perspective a little bit in that, like, you know, the research David Rock is citing, there's like been some very like these longevity studies. Michael Marmot wrote a book called I think it's Status. Oh gosh, I can't remember the exact title. Anyway, he's showing through like these longitudinal studies of this hierarchy. I think it was like British civil service, very hierarchical kind of organization. Mm-hmm. People mm-hmm. who are higher in the hierarchy are going to live longer and have better health outcomes.
Oh, wow.
Than people lower in the hierarchy. Like, so, and you know, controlling for all other kinds of variables and factors, like the higher your title, the more likely you are to like live a long, happy life. That's
wow.
That's, isn't that like like so depressing?
That is depressing. Oh my gosh.
But yeah. You know, there's been other research that's like corroborated that. So, you know, if you enjoy, like, and it makes sense, right? If you're at the top, you have so many existential threats are taken care of. Like, they're just like, don't exist.
What about
for
all
you?
The stress they had? Like, if you're, but I hear about all the CEOs that are stressed out and
I don't believe them anymore.
Doing drugs and no?
Okay. I don't believe, I think that's just something they say so that the rest of us don't feel jealous.
Don't. you don't want to be here. You don't want to have my job. You don't want to do it.
It's terrible. Meanwhile, they're going out, you know, golfing and
when
whatever.
Things go great, put me up on a pedestal. Yeah. When things are not so great for people, they just can't
exactly
execute.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, all joking aside, like the, you know, the science there is pretty compelling. So it's like, okay, you know, they're like status, it's not trivial. It's not like materialistic or anything to say like that mm-hmm. title is important to you. It's pretty hardwired into how we are as human beings.
It is.
And so even if like, you know, title itself might not be the thing that is motivating to you. It may be something like being known for your expertise,
yes.
Or like having a certain level of, you know, competition against your other people or against yourself. You know, those are all related ideas when we think about status. So, it, you know, it can be more than just like a formal hierarchy. It can be like being well known for what you do.
Yeah. I mean, I think if I, it feels good when someone comes to you and says, hey, I need your help with this. Or can you, someone, you know, or someone said that you're an expert on this and they kind of like pump you up. And you're like, yeah, you know, maybe I am.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It does feel good. It does feel good. Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, there's a lot of things, you know, when we think about, okay, how do we jazz people up around that stuff instead of, you know, I think there's so many instances where we inadvertently or unintentionally threaten people along these dimensions, which don't even have awareness about it. You know, lately I've been thinking a lot about like maturity models, and it's just, isn't that like intrinsically threatening to just be like, oh, we've evaluated your agile maturity and you guys are really immature. Like, thanks. Right. What's somebody supposed to do with that information?
The way I've done it when we do, maturity models is the team does it themselves.
Yes.
That's how I've always done it. We have a list of questions we follow, but the team self ranks. And to your point, it coming back to fairness, you ranked yourself. I mean, and I'm not doing it. I'm just facilitating the meeting. You guys tell me where you think you are. And then, what you think you want to work on to get better at. And that's, it's always gone great. Yeah.
And that like absolutely corroborates, you know, what David Rack is saying is, you know, ways of increasing rewards to status is asking people to evaluate their own performance. So instead of like giving them feedback or advice, like asking people to evaluate their own performance or just noticing like, oh, we've improved from the score that you gave yourself before to now, like there's been an improvement. Like those are ways to comment on it without triggering people. Usually.
Yeah. Oh. So
I was just going to ask before we wrap this episode up, I had a question for you on the titles topic, Michelle. Because every place I've been, you know, titles usually relate to some financial band, if you will, that you're tied to.
Right.
But there is a stigma. So it seems like there's some of these with the SCARF model, like many things, there's overlap in some of these. So I can see an overlap in status and fairness, for example. And so what would you say, because we probably all worked with somebody that is very, very tied to titles.
Yeah.
Of people. And you talk to somebody and they're very quiet. And you're like, hey, I just noticed you didn't really speak up. And this was something that I've heard you be very passionate about. I'm just curious. Why wouldn't you speak up? Oh, you know, I'm not going to, you know, Joanna, you know, she's a senior level, whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to question her authority.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So your question, like, how do you coach that person to be a little bit more open, or what are your, you know, what's your thought?
Yeah,
on
because that?
That
spreads, right?
Yeah.
That spreads throughout the team, and pretty soon it's one person, and then it's the other person, and then all of a sudden it's like everybody on the team is like deferring to this senior level person, and because they're very, they may have knowledge, they may have a title. And yeah. Everybody just kind of defers to them.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's some really interesting work by Edgar Schein on like this kind of dynamic. And the book is called Humble Inquiry. And he writes about it as, you know, from the first person. So if you are a leader and you want to make sure that you're creating a space for people to share information with you and not be intimidated by your title or status or what have you, you know, how to approach those conversations and how to create that space for, you know, people to come forward in that way. So, you know, if this is kind of like a third party situation where you've got like you're observing this dynamic that's happening in the team, I think mm-hmm. one thing that often like is sort of amazing to me, you know, in my work, like coaching executives, a lot of times, like the people who are in those positions, they can be unaware that other people are looking up to them in the way that they're like, they have a sort of some awareness of it, but then they think, well, I'm me. Like their self-concept is, you know, might be anchored from like 3 or 4, you know, promotions ago, like where they're like, I'm just a normal person. And I, you know, why would anyone be intimidated by me right. or my title? And so, you know, I think some of it is not even acknowledging or like, you know, having awareness that the title by itself can create that kind of barrier. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you might have a person who's really actually quite interested in hearing what others have to say, and they haven't acknowledged that might be a factor in their communication mm-hmm. with other people.
Yeah.
So, you know, asking, like sharing with that person, maybe, you know, one-on-one, like, here's something I've noticed this about the team conversation. Seems like, you know, when you offer your opinion, no one says anything else, or, you know, what have you observed about that? And, you know, you'll get different perspectives on it. Sometimes people will say, well, yeah, that's because I'm right. that's a whole other right. You know, avenue. For some people, it's, you know, they're thinking that they're making space for others, but they, you know, actually just aren't aware of that dynamic at play. And so, you know, if they're interested and curious to change that, you know, finding ways to connect individually with people. So like one-on-one, asking them, you know, some gentle questions, like just inquiring about them as people and getting to know them, like mm-hmm. at an interpersonal level, can create that space for some, you know, safety to grow. And so, you know, if you're coaching a team lead who no one seems to question, and they're a little perplexed by like, why doesn't the rest of the team have any ideas? Like, well, you know, yeah. what are some ways that you might go about bringing this forward? So it could be, why don't you go have a coffee with this person and just ask them, you know, ask them about their experience, ask them, you know, how you might help them. You know, so yeah. some of those things, especially for technical gotcha. Folks where they haven't been like maybe exposed to a lot of leadership thinking or training, you know, just encouraging them to focus on some relationship building can be eye-opening in a way that like you might think is obvious, but, you know, it may not have occurred to them before.
Definitely. Okay. This has been really great, Michelle. Thank you for joining us. So,
thank you.
We've been talking with Michelle about the SCARF model and why are people resistant to change. And we have a treat in store for you. So this is going to be part 1. We have a second part coming up after this one. So that one is going to be about some tips on how to overcome resistors to change and resistance to change. So with that, we thank everyone for joining. Cliffhanger. It's a cliffhanger. What are we going to talk about next? Michelle is coming back. Join us next time for that episode. So until then, this has been Greg and Mark and Michelle, with the Agile Within. We'll see you next time.